Blog Talk Radio.
And welcome to When the World is on Fire, the official podcast of the Young Patriots Organization. This is a call-in show, so if anybody wants to call in, the call-in number is 323-843-6094. We're also looking for sponsors for this show. If you need sponsors, look us up on Facebook, the Young Patriots Organization Birmingham, or Confessions of a Mad Redneck. And you could also be a patron of my content site, Confessions of a Mad Redneck, on Patreon. So I got Art Henderson and Hi Thurman here on the line. Y'all want to say hi?
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Art, how you doing? So, hi, can you tell us some of the stuff you got going on right now?
Yeah, well, right now there's several programs and activities going on. Actually, on the 21st in Chicago, there's a program with water rights that's being sponsored by the Young Patriots and an organization called Healing Corner and the People's Tribune. And it's going to be a benefit for these three organizations. And I understand that they have some people coming maybe from Flint, Michigan, and some of the American Indians coming in to talk about, what is happening with the water rights right now in this country. And they'll have music. And that's in Chicago. It's on the 21st. The Healing Corner, now I want to tell you a little bit about that. That is an organization that I had the privilege of being involved with in the summer of last year. There was a community where there had been a lot of gang violence and police shootings. Some people were killed. And so we actually go down and set up a booth or a table on a corner in these communities and get people to come out and talk about, you know, what they can actually do in their community, try to curb some of that, and also try to give some healing to those people that, that have lost loved ones you know, and we'd have programs for the kids and different types of activities and music and someone coming down doing drawings, paintings, and food, getting people involved in the community, and would actually get membership that way in the Healing Corner. Of course, we have the cops on one corner and the gangs on the other watching us, but we didn't run into any real problems there. But also, for those people that are going to be in if around Seattle, Washington on the 26th, I'll be giving a presentation at the 50th anniversary of the Black Panther chapter in Seattle, along with Chuck Armsbury, who was one of the original Young Patriot Party members up in Eugene. And we're also going to have some people from the Young Patriot chapter from over in the Chaplains on the Harbor going to come in, and we're going to give a presentation and show a little bit of the American Revolution II. And the purpose was to be is to be was to show how we and the whites and the black people actually worked together back in the 60s, and with Jose Chacho Jimenez of the Young Lords and Mike James and others of the Rising of Pingree got together, you know, actually formed this Rainbow Coalition, in which you, most of you know about Fred Hampton and what happened with him, and he was murdered, but that was because of this coalition. But we're going to be talking about that. I think Danny Glover is going to be the main speaker. He was the Panther, you know, the actor, and it should be a really good program. It's going to last for about 3 days. And so that's what's going on at this point, other than, you know, just working with the chapters and getting, you know, and just following along to see what the chapters are doing and offering assistance with that.
Hey, Art, do you have any announcements from your chapter up in Huntsville?
The only thing we have going is we're still fighting with the local Huntsville School Board regarding the cancellation of the auditorium facilities we were trying to secure for Alicia Garza's visit this past weekend, which had to be canceled due to her mother's illness with brain cancer. We're trying to get the school board to give us reasons or the reason for the cancellation of our approved usage of the school auditorium prior to the event. This is an ongoing question that we're trying to get resolved, and hopefully we'll know something in the next week or two. The only other
cool
thing that we have going is getting involved with the Poor People's Campaign, especially on the aftermath of Martin Luther King's 50th assassination anniversary.
Cool. Thank you. Thank you, Art. So the stuff we got going on here in Birmingham is our group here in Birmingham has been flocked to by a bunch of musicians, and we're trying to put together a benefit concert in August. I think August 25th is the date that we've set. We've got a budget. We've got some acts lined up, and we're trying to start raising money for that process. Now, I am also traveling around the state giving talks on anti-racist redneck identity. So we're trying to engage white working class Southerners in a dialogue about why white supremacy is bad for us and why it would be better to adopt an anti-racist culture. So it's basically a type of cultural organizing with white working class Southerners. I got one going on here in Birmingham, May 24th at Beloved Community Church. I got one going on up in Huntsville this Friday, but I think that's more of a private situation. And looking for more options, trying to set one up in Montevallo and maybe one in Mobile. So if anybody is interested in me coming and talk to you, you know, I play the banjo a little bit and talk about my life and how I've come to the conclusions that I've come to, you know, coming from a white working class background and, you know, having been raised with lost cause ideology and having figured out a way to get out of that. So try to go around and set an example for how maybe some white working class Southerners can do things a little bit differently. So hi, can you talk a little bit about your organizing in the 1960s and 70s? Can you talk a little bit about how you got the white working class who were migrants from Appalachia to work with the Young Lords and the Black Panthers?
Yeah, of course. You know, it was basically through commonality of what we had in common, because at that time, Chicago was one of the most racially segregated cities in the country, and it was around that way because of Mayor Richard J. Daley, who was, and we called him King Richard the First, actually, and he would, you know, deliberately keep people apart and keep them fighting through his cops, through the police department, through the politicians. You know, he despised poor people. He was a racist individual, and so there were a lot of police brutalities, murders within each of the Black community and the Hispanic community and the poor white community, which in the uptown area of Chicago, there were, you know, there at any given time, you know, 40,000 hillbillies living there that came there. We came there to find a better job. I came there when I was 17 from Tennessee, only to get, you know, to get some police brutality dished out to me 2 weeks later. I had kind of fallen in with a group of guys on the street who had been involved in the street gang. And they were closely, you know, aligned with SDS and Students for a Democratic Society that had come into the community to organize and at the directive of SNCC, when Stokely Carmichael said, organize your own, don't organize us, because we know how to organize. And so the whites started organizing, but even before that, there had been several organizing attempts and organizations in the uptown community. And the young guys kind of got together and led a march on the police station because of its police brutality and murder. And that's where they started picking up members. And at that time, they got away from the gang concept and started calling themselves the Goodfellas, which kind of associated with the mafia. But they were successful at that march. But right after that, you know, all hell broke loose. Another member was murdered by the Chicago cops. Now, after that, we also ran a presidential campaign with Eldridge Cleaver, and Peggy Terry was a poor welfare mother that lived in the community, just an amazing organizer, and so she was chosen to run for vice president. And that's where that's really where the Black community started looking at us in terms of us not being as racist as some of the others, you might say. You know, after that campaign, we kind of got together and called ourselves the Young Patriots. We also formed an organization that would go into the factories and try to organize poor whites, you know, against racism and economic injustices. And so, you know, we had some idea of organizing and coming from the South, you know, Blair Mountain and some of those other organizing and battles down there, we knew something about those. But there was only a handful of us in this entire community, which was pretty much a white supremacist community. But it was also a mixture of all kinds of different people, which there were a lot of clashes with people. But we kind of used that to organize to get people together. And one of the biggest controversies about it was when we were wearing the Confederate flag. And that's always been a point of contention here everywhere I go. But we wore that flag as a way of identifying other people identifying with us, and us, you know, and we were able to talk to them about this flag and how it was a flag of slavocracy, and it was a talking point, basically. And even with the Black Panthers, when we later joined with the Black Panthers, and the Lords and formed the Rainbow Coalition, we were security for the Black Panthers, and we were actually wearing the flag. Fred Hampton said that he, you know, of course, didn't like the flag, but he understood what we were trying to do was to organize around people around a racial issue, and that was a racial symbol. And we were able to, and we were successful at it. But as we grew in our ideology, we understood that that was counter-revolutionary. We understood that that was a symbol of slavocracy. So we did discontinue that flag. But we also were able to get, if you've ever seen American Revolution II, the documentary that was made about the Young Patriots and the Black Panthers back then, showing how we came together, you know, and really overcome a lot of obstacles. That will explain a lot of it. And
We got Alan Maxfield Steele, the co-executive director of Highlander Research and Education Center, on the line now, and he's our guest for today. How you doing, Alan?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me. It's good to hear your voice.
Yeah, it's really good to hear your voice. So, first thing I want to ask you to talk about is the history of Highlander and what type of strategies and tactics y'all have used in the past. What's your philosophy? What's your history? Where do y'all come from? Just let people know what Highlander is and what it's all about.
Cool. Thanks, Zach. And looking forward to connecting with High a little later, too. So Highlander's been around since 1932. We weren't originally here in New Market, Tennessee, which is in Jefferson County, which is just outside of Knoxville. We were originally in Grundy County after a handful of folks got together in the midst of the Great Depression and after thinking about strategies to address social change issues and transform the social order and economic order, as they called it, particularly in light of the Great Depression and particularly in light of a lot of unemployment and a lot of labor struggle back in the earlier part of the 20th century. So folks like Miles Horton, who's our most famous founder, and then Don West, Jim Dombrowski, Holt, and some others got together and approached a woman named Lillian Johnson in Summerfield, Tennessee, about using some of her land and property to start a school that would basically initiate social transformation from the perspective of people who were most impacted by it, mountain folk in that part of the state. So the basic idea was go to a place, figure out how to work from what local people needed and support their analysis and support their work and working together and figure out how to push back against the economic system that was dominant then, dominant now, capitalism, and figure out what does it look like to really do that. So we do a lot of the same stuff now. Strategies and tactics that Highlander's chosen are really broader formations that might want to come together to figure out how to work together, are invited to come in to learn together and map out things together, strategize, take a step back on the front lines and figure out how to set long-term strategy. Individual folks and smaller groups from communities that are most impacted, leaders that are emerging, organizing efforts, you know, bring them together to basically learn how to think together, learn how to push back on systems, map out systems that they want, really envision the transformative demands that they, or the transformative conditions that would actually help them meet their demands, not just meet them, but exceed them and liberate a society that they want. So tactically speaking, it's educational. Popular education as a methodology, language justice methodology, cultural organizing as a methodology, working across generations, doing research from a more participatory action research approach that considers people's experiences on their own wisdom and understanding of the local situation to do that kind of work. So, I mean, sometimes folks ask us what is different about what we do now versus what we did then. And it's not all that different in terms of the approach. The approach is always about being better educators for social justice movement work. And so reflective practice, you know, what does it really look like to bring a big group of people into a room and help them figure things out together? That's what we've always done.
So could you talk a little bit more about popular education? I know that Miles Horton, who's the founder of the Highlander Research and Education Center, was a big proponent of popular education. Could you speak to that a little bit more in depth?
Yeah, I think the basic idea is that people are teachers. All people are teachers and learners. All teachers are learners. All learners are teachers. So the idea isn't that there's a power differential between the teacher and the learner, the facilitator and the participant. I mean, there's something recognized about that, right? A facilitator convenes people and so has a certain level of power in the space, but the intentionality around leveling that power is about how that kind of educational process will go. So, you know, a lot of times it looks like, you know, trying to break down the hierarchy of what normal education or how banking or model of education, you know, that's a lot of Paulo Freire stuff, but they didn't really call it popular education when they started out. They just talked about it as being a school. It was called the Highlander Folk School at the time because it was like regular people coming together, not getting taught classes and that kind of thing, even though they did some of that at the beginning and they started realizing it wasn't working. And so I think one big approach is, you know, when you're talking with people, you're trying to figure out what's going to help them think, what's going to help them work together, what's going to help them talk to each other, and what's going to help them share experiences, help people who might be more marginalized in the space with folks who might have a little bit more power and privilege. What does it mean to level that power in that space? So there's a lot of work that's done to do that. A lot of times, some of the more specifics is that, you know, lectures aren't really the way that most people learn best. So when you start talking about how people think, lectures can be useful, but really people think and do better and learn more when they're hearing and they're doing and they're seeing, you know, all the different things that people might be able to do to engage all the senses in a learning experience. So I think that's something that's really important about popular education is that it's not about one particular mode of teaching or something like that. So that's kind of a snapshot. It's something you do. You know, sometimes it's harder to talk about it because it's actually something you do. But the intent of it is that it can actually encourage people to really just come from their own lived experience as the center of the experience and as the authority of that experience, as opposed to some expert telling everybody what they ought to think.
That's great. It's a great, probably one of the best descriptions of popular education that I've ever heard. So I was curious, you know, it's one of the best definitions I've ever heard. And, you know, I use popular education in my teaching and all of my organizing and in my teaching at UAB. And I find that what you say is correct is that when people have control of the educational process, they tend to actually learn more than they do with just somebody standing up front, say, memorize this or memorize that. You know, I think one of the big differences in the South now from when Highlander was founded is that when Highlander was founded, the South was largely a rural agrarian type of area. And now much of the South is organized, is urban, and is becoming more urbanized every day. So could you speak to the differences in approaches in rural organizing and urban organizing, or even if there is a difference in approaches?
I think that's a real interesting question. Sometimes I think that a lot is placed on the difference as opposed to the fact that people are who they are, you know. So I think I've lived in towns in the South or cities in the South that are more like country cities, as they've been described by people who've lived and were born and raised there, you know, where you really run into the same people all the time. You really recognize people based on just how the neighborhoods are formed together and that kind of thing. And I've lived in rural communities where people are completely isolated from one another, which is how some people experience cities. So I think that there's some myths to explode about some of the how people move and how people interact with each other in either context or any space. But I think organizing principles for rural communities, principles is a strong word. I think organizing approaches to that are that, you know, things may go a little slower, but that's not because people are slow. That's just because you're working across relationships that are really deeply founded and rooted in a particular place. And I think that that's one thing about rural work that's different than city work. I think you know, there's different questions around escalation and conflict in rural communities. You know, you might be wanting to stage a direct action against the guy that you're going to be eating lunch next to because you go to church with him on that Sunday. So there's a lot of power in that relational work that I think is a really significant. I think one myth that's really important to explode about the difference and also certainly about rural work, and this is a significant one in this moment, is that rural is not synonymous with white. It never has been. It would be a real ahistorical analysis to say that rural United States or rural South is a white place because that's only a several hundred year reality, at least in terms of the presence of white people and Euro-white people and Anglo-white people. So the United States South and the South in general and the mountains, indigenous, black and brown people and have been here for centuries, as long as there have been European white people. So I think that's something really significant to think about too, and I think that's a misnomer for a lot of rural organizing in this particular moment. Is that it's about working with the rural white working class and not all those different kinds of things, which is, it's not to say that it isn't, but it's just a lot more complex. And there's a lot of powerful black and brown organizing going on in rural communities all over the place in the South. So that's one thing I think rural organizers ought to think about, is that if they're working primarily in white communities, and that means they're not working in the black or brown communities, or they're not engaging with those strategies that might be really powerful to build with. That's just a couple of thoughts off the top. I mean, I think there's a really interesting book, a nice primer that I've found to be pretty useful from time to time when I talk about this, and I kind of point people in the direction of it. It's called Lessons from the Field. It was written about 15 years ago, maybe. And it's a snapshot of different rural organizing outfits, and some that are still around, some that are really powerful and doing amazing stuff now, some that may not be around anymore and have turned into something else. But Lessons from the Field is a book that I would totally encourage people to figure out how to get. Highlander, I believe we have some copies here, so if people want to order from us, we can definitely ship it to you. But it's a good book. You know, it's got good ideas and sort of story-based approaches to some of the work, and it's got some bullet points for people who are thinking about it and want to figure out some more of the details. That's just a snapshot.
It's important. I think what you said was really important about that. It's not that the rural South is not monolithic racially or really even ideologically or in any other way, shape, or form. That it's diverse just like other places are. But you know, I'm doing this. It's sort of interesting that you know we're doing this When the World is on Fire podcast, and for me, it's an opportunity for me to talk to people who I respect and admire, and get advice from them that I otherwise may not be able to get. And one of the things that, you know, Hyde just said was that, you know, Stokely Carmichael said that, you know, people should organize their own. And I've been doing urban organizing in Birmingham for 10 years, and I'm sort of feeling called to organize with white working class Southerners, what I call rednecks, people like myself. And one of the big cultural forms among white working class Southerners, lost cause ideology. And I wonder, do you have any strategies for being able to organize people with that sort of approach into a more type of justice oriented type situation?
That's a really good question. And I think it's one that, I mean, you might be asking in a different kind of way than other historians who kind of want to explore the idea of the lost cause as an academic subject. So I think from an organizing perspective, I think it's a theological question. And I say that in part because I think it's a story-driven, theological, destiny-driven kind of question that lives in the stories of white Southerners. And I don't come from a working class before white context. I grew up in two different places in the South, Texas as a military brat on an Air Force base in a city, and then all my people are from rural North Carolina and rural Georgia. And coming back and moving back to those communities, I definitely felt like a real palpable narrative that was told about, you know, who your people were and what they participated in. All that kind of stuff, but it never really got to the point, what does it mean to be accountable and responsible for that? One of the things that I've developed in terms of talking just to myself about it, but also with other people who might be in my situation, whether, you know, cross class,
or from real south or from the south in general who have better at past are that it's not necessarily your fault that people did it 150 years ago, 300 years ago, 400 years ago, but it sure as hell is your responsibility to fix it right now. And I think that that's one frame that I use, like fault versus responsibility is slightly different things. And so in terms of organizing and doing that work right now, it's definitely white people's responsibility to start addressing the long-standing legacy of, you know, total genocide of black and brown people on this part of the continent. And so I think, or the attempted genocide, I should say, because there's been a lot of powerful resistance against what our ancestors were doing. So I think the other piece, as a theological question, is I think that there's a way the Lost Cosmos, and I'm not an expert in that by any means, but my understanding is that it wasn't something that was necessarily initiated post, you know, Civil War. So I think there's a lot of historical and storytelling work that needs to be done. So if you talk about which part of the South, right, I know people who here in the mountains, I'm not from the mountains, but here in the mountains who will, you know, proclaim a particular Confederate past, and I know folks who are very clearly able to say, no, that's actually not our path. We actually were of a different political ilk then. We didn't really believe in the planter class's agenda economically or even racially necessarily. And there's ways to really point to that to start unpacking, like, where did that lost psychology and theology come from? And I think there's a lot to be done around that. And that's, I mean, I think that's the power of popular education, you know, popular education with community. It doesn't have to look like a workshop that you have at a place like Highlander. It can be in your kitchen. It can be in your backyard over a beer and food. It can be at the bar. It can be in the parking lot. It can be where people are at. That's ultimately what it should be. And I think having those kinds of conversations are really risk-worthy. In my own family, I've made a very intentional moves around the conversation of being, you know, not necessarily of the planter class, but certainly benefited from it and connected to it, because if you're in a rural community, you grew up in rural communities, you're living in a craft class reality. Your cousins might be born working class folks, and your uncle, the other uncle or aunt, might be owning class people, and you might be in the middle class somewhere. So you've got a living just a little bit more than others. And so the question around, like, what does that lost cause psychology attend to and mean, I think is a really important thing to unpack across family. So for me, it's been about really digging into family work, really working over the long haul with people in my own hometown, starting with the immediate family. Not everybody has the privilege of doing that or the ability to do that. They might feel really alienated or pushed away, but I've been fortunate to really be able to have, like, robust conversations with my folks about what it means to get into that. So I think there's a way that the lost cause stuff can be, in a long haul way, moved through, you know. I think it's important because it's not about, like, completely annihilating someone because of a particular thing that they may say. It's about building a really long haul relationship and holding them accountable to the truth. And I think that's kind of what that's my initial reaction to that question.
It's interesting because I was raised with a real lost cause type of ideology. I idolized Robert E. Lee. I was, you know, enraptured with the Confederate flag. And for me, I think it gave me meaning because it was a resistance narrative. And it's just sort of proof that, like, resistance narratives, just because they're resistance narratives or grassroots or working class, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're good or positive or productive in any way, shape, or form. So, it's interesting that I've been able to get out of it and over the years, and it's always sort of stuck with me, and sort of figuring out how to work through it is something that I'm really in a way that you're saying, which is sort of how do you work through it at the same time be accountable, is something that I'm really thinking about and thinking about my past and how I work through it through my past and figuring out how to, you know, share that with others. And I agree with you. I think it's a long haul type of thing. It's about building relationships of trust.
And I think that's interesting. You talk about resistance narratives. That helps me think about other ways of getting at it. Is that, like, there's no shortage of resistance narratives in Southern work or white work. I mean, there's a lot of folks who've been a part of different kind of resistance narratives over the last 150 years
pushing back against capitalist and racist work. And so it's a question of genealogy, maybe not biologically speaking, but certainly ideologically or politically speaking, to like, what stream do you want to step into? What stream do you want to choose to step into? And what kind of community do you want to make? And what kind of people do you want to make? If you are going to make people, what kind of future do you want to make? And I think that's kind of where I've thought a lot about it, because I can't say that I had an affinity for a Confederate path per se because of resistance as much as maybe you did. But I think that I definitely was kind of enthralled by the mystery and the romanticism of it. You know what I mean? Which is how I think it's taught. I think it's how it's talked about in white space and rural communities and in schools and stuff like that. But once you start poking open the other narratives and giving people an opportunity to really listen to other ways of understanding black resistance, enslaved people's resistance, indigenous resistance, and then white accomplices alongside them at the time, it's a different way of talking about a different story. And I think that's a really powerful way to talk about it.
Yeah, and there's no future. Like, this is one of the things that I always think about. If you, like, believe in the lost cause, there's no future. It's the lost cause. You know, like, there's no future in having that history or adopting that ideology. It's all a reactionary, like, nostalgic type of way of looking at the world. And, I mean, that's kind of where I'm at. So, we've been talking a lot about rural organizing, talking about how it's like diverse, that there's people of color in rural areas and there's a lot of work being done with them, and, you know, the different types of ideologies and stuff in rural organizing. And I'm curious about how do you build the bridges between urban organizing in the South and rural organizing in the South? And maybe that's not really even a question. Maybe it's easier than I think it is, but I am curious to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think that's a good question. I think, you know, just one way that we take that on here at Highlander is kind of what I was talking about at the beginning with Op-Ed and using a space in a rural setting, not just because it's pastoral in the sort of bucolic sense, right? It's not just like because we're out here because it's pretty, even though it's beautiful. It's also because it's like centering where our people are at and who we want to prioritize. So I think, but we don't want to not work with city-based folk or urban folks or ex-urban or suburban, because I think it's hard to talk about rural and urban without getting into the broader questions around how white capitalists and how white folks in general of the owning class are always claiming territory. And they're always taking territory up. So we can't talk about rural organizing in this particular moment around land and people being displaced from that, wherever they may be, whether they're white or black or brown or indigenous, and not talk about gentrification in urban communities, where black people in particular, brown people in particular, all across the country, and definitely in the South in this moment, have been displaced time and time again, whether it's in a rural context or in a city context, or they're being displaced to suburban context now because that was where white people wanted to live, but now they don't want to live there anymore. So they're pushing it out and making it affordable in a weird way to black and brown people who want to live out there. So I think it's about getting underneath the city and underneath the rural town or the small town. It's about land. It's about who owns it, who controls it, what's allowed to be done on it, and how it's collectively decided upon or not, in my opinion. And I think that's a bridging conversation to have. The more I see the dynamics between gentrification and colonialism, whether that's in a rural or urban setting, the more I see the dynamics and the way that people are talking about it, it lives differently. There's different players involved. There might be different political things you got to get involved in. It might be faster here, might be slower there, or whatever, but it's a lot of that. And I think, yeah, I'll start there as like one of the bigger bridging conversations to be had is around development. Problem of development, what is development that's necessary, and who controls it?
That's a really interesting answer, because I've always thought that territory is the single most important concept strategically for organizing, because who controls the territory also controls the politics. And but I've never really thought of what you said in the idea, and I guess it's because I haven't really done rural organizing, is that you know, the question of territory is kind of the same in rural, ex-urban, and suburban areas as it is in central cities. So that's a really interesting approach. So I want to open up the floor for questions from – we have three other callers. We have Art Henderson, who's the chair of YPO Huntsville. We have Hi Thurman, and we have a caller, another caller on the line. Would one of y'all would one of y'all like to ask Alan a question?
Yeah, I'll ask the question. Art here. Alan, could you share with those of us who are community organizers in our particular areas of the country? I'm from Alabama, by the way, Huntsville. And
cool.
I'm running into a lot of resistance with dealing with people that are open and closed to just having a discussion with one another. How do you overcome that? People that are closed to just having a conversation about these issues.
That's a great question. I mean, is that something new, or is that something that is it new work, or is it something that you're noticing? If that makes any sense.
Well, let me just share this with you. I'm a black male in my late 50s, and I've interacted with white working class people, white poor people, black working class, black poor, Asians, et cetera. And, you know, you hear a lot of these people when they just talk in general, they say, you know, they want to make a difference in this world. But when it comes to coming together, then the whole mindset changes. You know, we don't want to be associated with the Young Patriots because of your history. We don't want to be associated with blacks because of your history. Well, if you want to make a difference, then you need to open up. That's where I'm coming from.
I got you. Yeah, sometimes I do think it's a question of associations that are organizational and how they might get in the way of someone's relational ability to connect with somebody. I mean, I think there's identity markers. You know, it's like if white people are pushing back because they don't want to build relationships with black folk, that's ridiculous and unfortunate. But if they are talking about wanting to make change, it's like maybe working with local accomplices that help make sense in your situation of how to move those people where they need to be or where they could be. So it doesn't have to all fall on you. And I think the question around how do you get in the right relationship with people is a big goal. And sometimes that's better done with a sense of, I always talk about it with like a real non-anxious presence, right? Like trying not to make it about a political aim necessarily, or a deeper political aim, which is about relationship, which is about restoration of wholeness for folks in their communities, which might sound super weird and philosophical, but for me, it's about taking time. The other piece too is like being in a rural setting, I think it's super isolating for some folks, particularly if you're politically one direction or another. And so it's about trying to find ways to really build with people that are your comrades and just making sure you're doing that kind of work, because it can be really isolating. And that's different than like what some people call self-care. I think that's actually just like finding political home and really trying to build it out. I think there's some other really interesting opportunities, and if you get one or two people to kind of do things that they do with each other, you know, like watch things together, go to concerts, go eat together if you can, you know, like go to music and kind of engage people where they're at, and really try to listen for that whole person, then that can help really go far away. But ultimately, you know, it's a values question too, and you start trying to think about like what are the values that we're digging underneath here, like what are people actually talking about? They're talking about fairness. Starting with that, sometimes it's not about capitalism. Sometimes it's about fairness. Sometimes it's about relationship. It's not necessarily about all these words that sometimes people are kind of using as lightning rod words, even though those are the words. So that's just some initial thoughts.
Yeah,
even, okay.
Martin Luther King, because even Martin Luther King said, you know, it's an economic thing. You know, it's the haves versus the have-nots, and the haves don't want to really want to really want to associate with the not.
But when you look at the where their owners are,
yeah, I think that's real. I mean, I think there's also just it's hard to separate the kind of a race and economic reality from the South, right, or from this country. So I think the construction of both are real hand-in-hand and then really entangled. And so it's a question of kind of figuring out what that looks like in a particular setting and working through from a relational perspective, like how do you really build through that, build power around changing.
So, caller, do you want to ask Alan a question right quick?
I'm not.
You're on the air.
No, I'm not. Can you hear me? Yeah, can you
yes,
hear me?
You're on the
Am
air.
I muted
you're
or
on
you?
The air.
Yeah, okay.
You're on
okay,
the air.
Great. Right, I got it. Got it. My name's Eric Feinblatt, by the way. I don't want to be just identified as caller. We live in a rural community in upstate New York, and one of the issues here has been kind of the influx of people. It's about 2.5 hours from New York, the influx of people from New York City who have bought second homes here, who come up here and rent places through Airbnb, spend summers here. And we're quite interested in getting these two. These communities really do not interact whatsoever. And we're very interested in starting conversations between these two communities, because the one thing that we find that they share is some kind of a claim to place, to the land. And our work has been very, very different in the past. Most of our work has been in South America or in Asia, working with garbage scavengers. But we, and also with indigenous people in South America, in communities that have been affected by mining. But one of the things that we've learned is the importance of understanding or trying to understand and make connections with people through their connection to the land itself. And we're starting something here called a forest exploratorium, where we're trying to host conversations between these two communities, because we find that that's kind of the common denominator that they share. And I wondered if you've had any experience with that, Alan, just going about taking that tactic to start these conversations.
I mean, like finding middle ground, kind of common stuff that both that people both like. Yeah, I think that's a smart move.
Specifically the middle ground being claims to place.
Sure.
You talked about territoriality, and you didn't mention land sovereignty, but certainly that was something in the background of what you were saying, and something that we understand through indigenous studies struggles in the United States and elsewhere.
Totally.
But there seems to be this common connection to place here that seems to be a good starting point for conversation.
I think that's real, and I think it's smart to kind of lean into that for a little while and assess it later. I think that for me, I'd flag questions not because of what you're doing, but just for down the road, and maybe from the beginning thinking about it. It's like, who's responsible for holding the conversation? And if there are places where rules are made, who's making them and who has to abide by them? Particularly in like common areas, common place, public land, I think there's a real fragility right now to the concept of what is public. And that's like a very academic way of saying something that I think could be plainer, which is like there's a real fragile way of looking at like who owns stuff. And owning stuff means more than just private property. It means, like, who governs the place, who's responsible for the place, how is it equitably resourced? And I think that this might be getting a little bit away from your question, but I think that to the idea of like using people's cultural relationships to place, super smart. I think
definitely what you're
going,
all those issues of power are certainly are what motivate us to do it. But if
totally.
You have those those direct conversations, you're not going to get a lot of traction in the beginning. There has
totally.
To be some other entry points.
Yeah, you may not need to do it at the beginning. You want to crack a beer open with somebody at the beginning. You know, you want to have some food with somebody at the beginning. You want to enjoy that place or those places together with somebody at the beginning.
Right.
And you want to do those things. You want to get to know each other's families. I mean, I come from a particular – I mean, you talked about being in Southeast Asia. I spent some time there as a student and as an organizing apprentice, for lack of a better term, with organizers who then – came back in Thailand, who then came to the south of me and spent time with me here and wanted to learn how rural organizing looked here. And one of the mentors that I have from that experience in those years was like, the goal is, like, if we're not building friendships and relationships, then what are we actually really going for? I mean, I think accountability, I think militant organizing, I think all that stuff's really important. But the end game is like relationships, so it's also not a bad idea to start there. So I think it sounds like you're doing that right. But I think those questions of ownership, not ownership in the strictest private property sense, but ownership in terms of like collective conversations and decision making, those stuff will come up. And so I think just kind of keeping an eye on your own social location in that, your own political position in that, and just kind of figuring out ways to accompany the leveling of that. Is a really important thing.
Thank
of
you
course,
for the
ownership. But go ahead.
Thank you for the question, Eric. We got to wrap up. We got about 8 minutes left, and I have one more question for Alan. Thank you for your question, and thank you for calling in.
Great.
Hey, Alan, the last question I have for you is, what is your vision and hope for the future?
You know, I'm going to end with what I've been experiencing this last few days. I was on my way to Cincinnati for something on Friday morning. I got a call from an old friend who said that there had been a massive ICE raid near Morristown, Tennessee, in a community Bean Station or Rutledge, which is in Granger County, Tennessee, and that's a neighboring county. It's real close by to Highlander, and so we're old friends, but we're also really close by because of Highlander, so she asked if I'd come out and help support, and they're part of the Tennessee Immigrant and Refugee Rights Coalition. They were kind of quick on the response alongside some local agencies that were working hard and good friends and some local churches who are impacted by this raid. It's been the largest raid in over 10 years, some are estimating. It was at a meatpacking plant, and families are being shredded and ripped apart. Folks are facing deportation, and there's just been an incredible outpouring of robust organizing, but really meeting the immediate and direct needs in this, you know, in the last several days. But then also starting to kick up this question of like, what does it mean to come together as a community to really keep our people together? And there's glimpses of that this past weekend, you know, where in responding to this crisis that so many families, so many brothers and sisters of ours in the immigrant community were experiencing, that you have local churches coming from across denominations, you have lawyers who are coming from totally different faith systems, you have people who are atheists who are like sitting in a Catholic church, everybody working together trying to, you know, figure out how to keep our people together. People eating together, singing together, crying together, holding each other, and then a whole bunch of people throwing down on, you know, what it means to keep people alive and keep children from being too afraid, even though they've been traumatized. And even though that's the chaos of a moment of, you know, the state's total and utter assault on people, what I saw was just incredible examples of just what we as human beings are capable of. I saw people like this guy named Tim from, I think he's from Florida, but he's been living in Tennessee for the last little while, say, you know, this is the most amazing experience of my life. He's 63 years old. He's a plumber. And he's saying, like, why should he, like, it's absolutely, you know, sinful for these folks to be taken away from each other. When I hear that, I hear the future. When I see young people whose parents have been, you know, shackled and taken away from them, speaking out into cameras and getting up in front of vigils that are packed in high, you know, elementary school gymnasiums full of 1,000 people, singing organize, organize, organize alongside each other, like my co-director Ashley Henderson guided them in. When I hear people singing together, and it's coming from people that you would never have thought it was coming from necessarily, that's the public narrative, but it's because they're with their people and they want their people back. I envision a future in which people are doing that all the time, and that future is right here. I mean, it's like happening right now. There's a lot of resistance to the state's assault on our communities and the state's attempt to fragment people from each other from the empire's, you know, centuries and millennia-long attempt to destroy people's well-being and livelihood. And it's just been awesome to see that. I think I've been in the future in this last weekend. It's been kind of remarkable. But I want to be able to, as my co-director Ashley Henderson says, not just, you know, get the wins, but also protect and defend the wins. And I think that's the vision that we haven't seen yet. We got to win a lot more and defend those things. So that's my answer. And it's kind of amidst this crisis that's going on. So if y'all don't mind making sure that you check out Tennessee Immigrant and Refugee Rights Coalition Facebook page and just start pumping up everything that you see, share it, blast it out, draw attention to this crisis, and draw attention to this amazing resilience and resistance of this community. I'd appreciate that.
All right. Thank you for coming on with us, Alan. And this has been a really good episode. So you've made it really excellent. A lot of deep stuff to chew on for people. So I'm really happy that you were able to come on with us, and I deeply appreciate it.
This has been a joy. I always do anything for you, Zach. Thank you so much. And hi, it was good to hear your voice again, and nice to meet the other folks too. So thank you so much.
All right. Peace.
Yeah, y'all be good.
All right, we're going to wrap up tonight. If y'all want to get in touch with us, contact us through Facebook on Young Patriots Organization Birmingham, Confessions of a Mad Redneck. Become a patron of Confessions of a Mad Redneck on Patreon. If anybody wants to sponsor, please let us know. We definitely need sponsors. And I'm going to play y'all out with the Young Patriots song.
Young patriot, I struggle for right, not for security alone do I fight, but the freedom to be whatever you might be. If we live in socialism and not slavery, I am a young patriot and I have a creed. I believe in others 'cause we have believed. Not in the rights of rulers, but humanity. To be healthy and happy and to be free. Young patriot, a term I define, not a matter of age, but a state of mind. And if you love freedom for liberty, you care. Join the young patriots and fight for it there. Yeah, join